Chapter 5. The Seer of Fatima from Tai to the Carmel of Coimbra, 1942-1948. Fatima, Rome, Moscow. For a moment we must lose sight of these three capitals, where in this turning point of the century, the future of the Church and the world was going to be decided, and return to our seer in the humble city of Tai. There her soul was completely absorbed by the Angelus Ecclesiae, by the great concerns of the holy hearts of Jesus and Mary, who continued to confide in Lucy. She also had to bear another pain, lead another struggle, a more intimate and secret struggle but a very painful one to perfectly correspond, finally, to her divine and original vocation, to be a Carmelite. But before recalling the difficult paths by which God willed to lead her, we can do no better than quote here from some of her letters from this period. These letters express very well both the secret of her soul and the very heart of the great secret revealed by Our Lady of Fatima at the Cova da Iria. The Immaculate Heart of Mary, Our Final Salvation. In May 1943, the Bishop of Gurza announced to her the consecration of a parish or a community to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the context does not tell us which. On May 27, the seer answered him. I am very grateful and I thank Your Excellency for your letter and the printed matter I received the day before yesterday, I was pleased with them and I thank you for it. Love is not loved. The news of the consecration they are making over there, with all the details you give me, gave me great pleasure, because it reveals a great deal of love for the Immaculate Heart of our Heavenly Mother who is so good, and through her, for our good Lord. They love us so much. What they desire the most is to see their love known, and to see us correspond to it. This is one of their common complaints, I love, and I am not loved, I manifest myself, and I am not known, I give and nobody responds, to my advances. The Feast of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. I desire very ardently the institution for the Universal Church of an office in honor of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. When I stated this request in my letter to the Holy Father, I presented it as a simple desire of my poor heart, and so I felt it to be, but in reality this desire is not only my own, someone has placed it in me. It comes from the most holy hearts of Jesus and Mary. Devotion to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, salvation of souls. They love and desire this cult because they use it to draw souls to them, and this is their whole desire, to save souls. Many souls, all souls, salver almas, muitas almas, todas as almas. Our Lord told me a few days ago, I desire very ardently the propagation of the cult and devotion to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, because this heart is the magnet which draws souls to me, the fire which makes the rays of my light and my love beam out over the earth, and the inexhaustible well causing the living water of my mercy to gush over the earth. If these communications are certain, I feel that they are, in spite of so many fears, I do not want to prevent them from being communicated to souls. This is why I give them to you. They are not mine, I myself am nothing. Do with them what you feel will be the most useful for the glory of God. On the 31st, I will be there in spirit. I ask you to be so good as to bless me. The great promise which fills me with joy. Shortly afterwards, on April 14, 1945, Mother Cunha Matos, superior of the house at Tai since October 1944, was getting ready to leave for Fatima. Sister Lucy wrote her this charming letter, where she opens her heart like a daughter and at the same time forcefully expresses the wonderful promise which is the very essence of the message of the Immaculate Virgin at Fatima. I hope that you will not forget me there, over there at the feet of our little Heavenly Mother, and that you will tell Jacinta at length of my tender feelings for her, and how I miss her. Do not think I am sad that I too cannot go there. I offer this sacrifice with pleasure, because with this we save souls and I always remember the great promise which fills me with joy, I will never leave you alone. My Immaculate Heart will be your refuge and the way which will lead you to God. I believe that this promise is not for me alone, but for all souls who wish to take refuge in the heart of their Heavenly Mother, and let themselves be led along the paths traced out by her. It seems to me that such are the intentions of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, To make this ray of light shine before souls once more, to show them once more this harbor of salvation, always ready to welcome all the shipwrecked of this world. As for myself, while I savor the delicious fruits of this beautiful garden, I strive to make access to it easier for souls, so that they satisfy their hunger and thirst for grace, comfort, and help. A Pilgrimage to the Sources, Lucy at Fatima, May 21 to 22, 1946. On May 13, 1946, the extraordinary solemnities of the crowning of Our Lady by the Papal Legate took place at Fatima. Canon Galamba recalls, 2 short weeks of this glorious series of events and impressions had just gone by, when the news was given to us in a hushed voice, Sister Lucy is coming to visit Fatima, Algestral, and the Covada area. It was true. Adieu, Spain. On the afternoon of May 16, Sister Lucy had been asked to prepare to leave Valencia do Minho to spend the night at El Asilo Fonseca. On the 17th, she arrived at the College of Sardeo, one of the Portuguese houses of the Dorotean sisters located at Vila Nova de Gaia, a little south of Porto. On May 20th came the departure for Fatima, in the company of the Reverend Mother Vicar and the Mother Provincial. Arriving at the Covada area at nightfall, the religious had just a little time to pray a bit at the Capelinha and the Basilica. Next morning, when Bishop da Silva arrived, after they exchanged greetings, the Mother Provincial told the bishop that the Mother Vicar had decided Sister Lucy was to stay in Portugal. Thus, as she listened to this conversation, the seer learned that she would not return to Tai. What news? Sister Lucy attended the bishop's mass, and afterwards, Canon Galamba's mass. She took her breakfast with Bishop da Silva, and then had a long conversation with him. A wonderful pilgrimage. That afternoon, everyone went to the Cabico and to Algestral, so that Lucy could point out the blessed places where the angel had appeared. These places still were not known with certainty, because the hill presented many places which could possibly fit the seer's description. Canon Galamba had the privilege of accompanying Sister Lucy on this pilgrimage, the first for her since her departure for Porto in 1921. Here is his description. There she was, joyfully stepping across the road to the Loca do Cabico. The local superior of the Dorotean sisters was accompanying her. We followed the shortcuts to avoid unhealthy curiosity, or the bothersome attitude of the indiscreet. After some long detours, we went up the slope of the Cabico from the southwest side, stepping over the soft carpet of dry foliage, half rotted by time and covered by a great variety of wild flowers. Sister Lucy loves flowers a great deal and now, led here by divine providence to the places of her childhood, she feels like a little girl once more. She begins gathering flowers and making bouquets with the same avidity as of old. We were protected from the sun's heat by the cool shadow of old oak trees and other leafy trees, which cover the slope in part. We felt content at having her present there, although only for a few moments. When she arrived at the top, she sat down. Near her was the superior, and at her side, the other members of the group. This was the place of the first vision of a strange personage who did not reveal himself, but had come in advance to prepare her for the apparition which would be seen not far from there, shortly afterwards. She described the past events once more. While answering some rather tricky questions, she stressed the objective reality of the apparitions, denying the possibility of a dream or an illusion. No, I was very much awake, and I saw the apparition, as I see your reverence now. And concerning the communion at the Loca, she insisted once more, I felt the physical contact of the sacred host on my mouth and on my tongue. The effort of the walk and the climb, the joy of this long-desired contact with nature, the beauty of the flowers and the panorama, the unspeakable memories of that day long ago, the scenes of old brought back to life, the gentle light of sunset, all give her countenance an unexpected grace. Her soul reflected onto her face a resplendent and transforming light. In her glance there was reflected something indescribably mysterious, luminous, joyous, anxious, an expression of hope and certitude, heaven and earth mingling and joined together so well that I never saw the like nor shall I see it again. Lucy was different. It is the happy spontaneity of the moment that I publish in this text. Then we went around the mountain, and when we approached the place where the loca was thought to be, spying her actions and her face, we saw her go away without any further explanations. "Wait, I will come right back." Then she continued walking until she was in sight of Algestral. A little while later, she came back and invited us to follow her without stopping there. We found that a little strange, and we asked her a natural question: "The loca is not here?" "No." Then she took the pathway she had found, and which no one had walked over since her departure for Porto. We followed her, astonished and curious. Then, for the first time, we contemplated with our eyes the rude stones of the Loca do Cabico, sanctified by the contact of the Angel of Portugal and made famous by her apparitions to the three shepherds of Algestral, chosen in their humility by divine providence to be the protagonists and instruments of the most transcendent and wonderful religious events of modern times. Not without profound emotion, we heard her repeat the account, indicating the spot where each of the participants of this great hour was, the angel and the shepherds. Then she knelt, we too knelt and, in a murmur, we repeated with the seer, with great feeling, the words that the angel had taught for the first time in this same place. My presence there, in such circumstances and in such company, undoubtedly constitutes a high point of my life. Leaving this blessed place, the heart seems to bleed somehow. The sister took a little stone with her. On the way down, we went through Valinos and we stopped there a little while. Next, they went to Algestral. They visited the well where the angel had appeared in the summer of 1916, then the parish church of Fatima, and finally the cemetery where Jacinta and Francisco's mortal remains reposed. They then returned to the Cova da Iria, where Sister Lucy was able to watch the film of the Jubilee celebrations of 1942. She was also shown the rich crown of Our Lady. Sister Lucy, during her pilgrimage to Fatima and Algestral, May 21 to 22, 1946. Pius XII and the Third Secret. The following day, Lucy saw her sisters, Maria dos Anjos, Teresa, Gloria, and Carolina. She spoke with Father DeMarchi, and late in the morning, with Canon Formigeo. Some of the words exchanged at that time are worth reporting. We know about them from the account published shortly afterwards in the Review Stella. "When do you expect to return to Spain? I must leave these places tomorrow without knowing where I shall go." Then the canon added these words, which are vitally important for the history of the Third Secret. "It occurred to us that on this occasion the seer might perhaps be called to Rome to tell the Holy Father, Pius XII, the third part of the secret of Our Lady of Fatima, to which she refers in her latest writings." Father Martins dos Reis adds this comment. Very probably Canon Formigeo was not ignorant that it was, in fact, believed the seer would go to Rome. To this end, even the necessary contacts were begun and facilitated. She herself entertained some hopes of success, which in the end could not be realized. The longing for Carmel. And the return to Vila Nova de Gaia. From the house of the Dorotean sisters, Sister Lucy could see the Carmel of Fatima, a bit higher up on the hill. It had been founded recently, not far from the basilica. In the charming account of her journey she notes, "Who would have granted me to go to Carmel, which I saw through a window? But I well knew that this permission would not be granted me. It was more prudent not even to ask for it." After a farewell to the Capelinha, and a stop at Liria, it was time to return to Porto. They arrived at 1 o'clock in the morning at Vila Nova de Gaia, at the College of Sardeo, where Sister Lucy was to reside for almost 2 years. However, her inner resolution had already been made. Under the impulse of grace, she felt moved to request her admission to Carmel. Was this the moment she forwarded her request to the Pope? We do not know with certainty. A new letter to the Pope. Nevertheless, Villalta Burbel reports, in the month of July, 1946, Lucy wrote a letter to Pius XII, She certainly manifested to him her desire to see him and speak with him personally. Or did she write to him also to request authorization to be transferred into the cloister of Carmel? The vocation to Carmel. It must not be imagined that this was a sudden whim on the part of our seer. Like Charles de Foucauld, whom God had called to leave La Trappe, Sister Lucy was very happy at Tyre and was loved very much there. Later on she had this to confide to Archbishop Garcia y Garcia, her former director, writing, "I have a lot of nostalgia for the beautiful years spent at Tyre. These are the days awaiting us in heaven." Her Spanish entourage knew it, to the point where it caused them to be mistaken. Thus the holy Don Luis Varela, who knew her very intimately, told Father Alonso that Sister Lucy would never have left the Dorotheans if she had remained at Tyre. Might she have left them because of her transfer to the College of Sardeo? This supposition is certainly inexact, for we know through other channels that the question of her vocation was a long and painful calvary for Lucy. It lasted almost 25 years. We have described how at Asilo de Villar, around 1923 to 1924, she had already seriously considered the Carmelite life. However, the superior of the Institute, Mother Magalhaes, had dissuaded her from it. Without giving the precise dates, Canon Galamba reveals that she also thought for a moment of joining the new community formed by Canon Formigeo, to correspond to the Most Holy Virgin's final requests to Jacinta, during the latter's stay at Lisbon. Lucy considered herself called to this work of reparation, and she had practically resolved to enter it. Who intervened to make her change her mind? This is what we do not know, and perhaps only Lucy herself knew, and out of charity did not say. Her uncertainty lasted a long time. Why did she not go there? It is not hard to believe that the religious of the new foundation made all the sacrifices possible to have among them the only survivor of the three shepherds of Fatima. Yet, it did not happen. With immense modesty and perfect purity of intention, the seer submitted to the authorities on whom she depended, the religious, the spiritual director and the whole limited group of her relations were unanimous in saying, a religious. Perfect. But where, if not with the Dorotheans? So Sister Lucy entered the postulancy. Canon Galamba writes. She continued her immolation and her total self-sacrifice. Like the College of Villar, the novitiate was a long and intense school of abnegation and humility. Only God knows how many unknown moral sufferings are mingled with the history of these years, so fruitful for the rest of her life. Only God knows well His designs and His plans in what concerns each soul. The month of October 1928, when she was to make her first vows, had arrived. She had decided. She would consecrate herself to God in the Institute of Saint Dorothy. Her trial did not abate at all. Sister Lucy opened up to her superiors, who did not understand. For some of these good religious, all this yearning for contemplative life was only a temptation. They were upright souls, well-intentioned, but dominated by the idea and the desire of having the seer of Fatima in their congregation. An example is given to us by a certain superior, who told her one day, "Listen, my sister, I think that is a temptation. But since I have a great desire to see you with us, and since I have a great deal of love for you, I fear that this may be the reason I think so. It seems to me that the best thing is for you to open up to His Grace the Bishop, and follow all his advice. If you want to write a sealed letter, I give you complete permission, and if you want to speak with him, tell me, I myself am ready to ask permission for you to go there, and if you know that such is the will of God, tell me, I am ready to ask for all the authorizations to help you at every step. Still, it will cost me a great deal to convince myself that such is the will of God." As the year 1934 approached, the year when she was to make her perpetual vows, the thought of Carmel once more powerfully imposed itself. In 1933, she writes, "I have received a letter from Father Aparicio in which he tells me that he will come to Tyre as soon as I return there. I hope that he will bring me some decision concerning the Carmelites. May God grant that it be for me to go there, although I am a little afraid because of my health, but I have confidence that if the good Lord permits it so, he will give me the strength, frail though in reality I am, it also seems to me that I have more the reputation for being so than the privilege. Still, Sister Lucy obeyed once more. On October 3, 1934, she pronounced her perpetual vows at Tai in the presence of Bishop da Silva. Canon Galamba continues, the Lord has prepared her for her life as a Carmelite by innumerable sacrifices, through inaccessible, rocky, and difficult paths. On the last 10 years there is nothing to say. It was an arduous and secret struggle. Father Alonso notes for his part, the years 1946 to 1948, right up to her entrance into the Carmel of Coimbra, were hard trials for Lucy's virtue. She saw that she was almost forced to directly request the Pope for her transfer to Carmel. The Messenger of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, 1944 to 1948. While grace drew her more and more to the silence and solitude of the cloister, Sister Lucy did not therefore forget her mission as Messenger of the Immaculate One. Jesus wishes to use you to make me known and loved, Our Lady had told her on June 13, 1917. We have described how, at the beginning of 1944, she had expressed the desire of speaking personally with the Holy Father. Undoubtedly, what she had in mind was to talk about the third secret, which she had just written down, the warning intended for the bishops of Spain, and the consecration of Russia, which still had to be accomplished according to Our Lady's exact requests. The Bishop of Gurza had to answer her that he could do nothing, there were too many difficulties, etc. Sister Lucy never rebelled against the authority on which she depended. Still, she did not resign herself to inactivity. On March 2, 1945, she wrote to Father Aparicio. I rejoice at the progress which devotion to the Immaculate Heart of Mary is making everywhere. In the present times, this is what will save us. It would be necessary to greatly intensify prayer and sacrifice for the conversion of Russia. Although the consecration of this nation has not been done in the terms requested by Our Lady, we will see if we will obtain its return to God. I have great hopes, because the good Lord knows the many difficulties. She also knew, however, that in the end everything depended on the decisions of the Pope. Hence she added. Over there, Father Aparicio was a missionary in Brazil at the time, do they pray for the Holy Father? It is necessary to pray unceasingly for His Holiness. Days of great affliction and torment still await him. While awaiting the great salutary decisions which the Pope alone could provide, Sister Lucy discouraged no effort, however small, that went in the same sense as Our Lady's requests. She also rejoiced that priests and the faithful were taking to heart the conversion of Russia. Three priests wrote to her on the subject. A French priest, Father Terrier, even came to Tai personally. Nevertheless, as Sister Lucy explained to Father Aparicio on January 11, 1946, I didn't speak to him and I didn't answer the others, which was rather painful for me, since it concerned the conversion of Russia. I was unable to do so because now more than ever, I have rigorous orders for correspondence and visits. That does not astonish me. God's works are always persecuted. The only thing that pains me is that for this purpose, the devil has used a father of the Society of Jesus. I don't know what things he told the Reverend Mother Provincial. But, the poor man, let us leave him be. I believe he thinks he is doing a good thing. The good Lord will be able to work everything to his own glory. As for writing to the Holy Father, who am I? I so recognize my incapacity and unworthiness that I do not dare to do it except out of obedience. The good Lord will be able to work everything to his own glory? In effect, 3 weeks after the seer wrote these serene words concerning the campaign of critics mounted against her, Father Janjan, a Dutch Montfort father, arrived at Tai. He had come expressly to perform his own inquiry on the spot, to respond to Father Danny's objections with exactitude. He remained at Tai on February 3 and 4, and was able to interrogate Sister Lucy at length. The account of this interview was published shortly afterwards in the review Mediatrice et Reine. It already constituted a serious refutation of the false allegations of Father Danis, the adversary of Fatima. Sister Lucy also took advantage of the occasion to firmly recall Our Lady's exact requests concerning Russia. 3 months went by. On May 13, the occasion of the crowning of Our Lady of Fatima, Pius XII pronounced a magnificent radio message. As we have said, it was seriously considered at the time that Lucy go to Rome to speak with the Pope. Unfortunately, this project was abandoned, we do not know why. Sister Lucy had to content herself with writing to the Pope. Her letters to the Holy Father were monitored and corrected by her superiors, it just was not the same. On July 15, the seer once again insisted on the subject of Russia before another questioner, William Thomas Walsh. After expressing her pain that the Pope and the Bishop still had not obeyed Our Lady, she summarized in one sentence what Our Lady expects of all the faithful: the people must recite the Rosary, do penance, receive communion on 5 Saturdays in a row, and pray for the Holy Father. The few months she spent at Villa Nova de Gaia, at the College of Sardeo, were for Sister Lucy a period of intense literary activity and testimony on the apparitions. In the beginning of July 1946, she received Father de Fonseca. At the same moment she answered a long questionnaire sent to her by a Frenchman, J.J. Goulven. On August 12, 1946, she received a Discalced Carmelite accompanied by John Hafford, the future co-founder of the Blue Army. On October 17 and 18, she received Canon Barthes. She answered new interrogations and corrected several works that she had been requested to reread. In February 1947, she spoke with Father MacGlynn, who was preparing to sculpt the great statue of Our Lady for the facade of the Basilica. She repeated to him, with insistence, the precise request for the consecration: no, no. Not the world. Russia, Russia. For the solemnities of 1947, the 30th anniversary of the apparitions, she requested people to pray especially for this poor Russia. During the solemn Mass on May 13, a beautiful prayer, composed by Miss Irene Poznoff, who was soon to intervene so effectively for the realization of Our Lady's requests, was recited in Russian, while the text was distributed to the pilgrims in French and Portuguese. Little by little, then, the truth was coming to light. Fatima was being understood as the world's great hope, because it was the final recourse to obtain the conversion of Russia from heaven. Father A. M. Martins relates that in 1947, somebody had the idea of promoting a campaign of prayers for the conversion of Russia at the national level, and had a few leaflets printed up. A friend of Sister Lucy told her about this campaign and sent her some copies of the leaflets. Sister Lucy answered, "I am very grateful for Your Excellency's letter, and the little leaflets you have been good enough to send me, I thank you very much. This pleased me very much, and if this is to be propagated, and you would send me some more, I will have the opportunity to distribute them to some people who will gladly join this campaign of prayers, which is so necessary. Yes, it is necessary to save Russia at the price of prayers and sacrifices. For this purpose, the greater the extent of the campaign, the better it will be." This campaign of prayers was intended at the same time to obtain from the Pope the decision for a real consecration of Russia. Indeed, it was arranged that in 1948, the Patriarch of Lisbon would offer the Holy Father the large album containing all the promises of prayer and penances made by the faithful, for the conversion of Russia. Moreover, we know that in the summer of 1947, Sister Lucy again desired to speak to the Holy Father. She wrote on September 7, 1947, "As for the request I desired to make of His Holiness, asking for the worldwide day of prayer and reparation for Russia, according to Our Lady's request. March 25, 1948, entrance into Carmel." On August 27, 1947, the Secretariat of State, in the name of Pope Pius XII, ask the Bishop of Porto to facilitate Sister Lucy's passage from the Congregation of Dorothean Sisters to the Order of Carmel. On this occasion, Pius XII was really a father for her, a relative of the seer recently confided to me. In spite of this personal intervention of Pius XII, the seer's entrance from Fatima to Carmel was not brought about without stubborn opposition. As Father Alonso reports, when her superiors, as well as the Bishop of Liria, put up the greatest difficulties for this change, Lucy threatened to withdraw to a Carmel of Spain which the Archbishop of Valladolid had just founded at Tordesillas on June 23, 1945. The decision came like lightning, she would enter the Carmel of Coimbra. In effect, she entered there on March 25, the day of the Annunciation and Holy Thursday of 1948. Her most cherished desire had been fulfilled, she was finally going to be a Carmelite. If Bishop da Silva was unhappy about it, he had to resign himself to it. He wrote to her, "I have had the consolation here of knowing that you are in a Carmel I have known since my student life, because I went to the church to celebrate Mass there almost every day. From there, you will go up almost straight to heaven when our Lord shall call you." A few weeks later, on May 13, 1948, the seer of Fatima took the habit of a Carmelite, and received the name of Sister Mary Lucy of the Immaculate Heart. She made her one profession, a solemn profession, on May 31, 1949. From then on she was dead to the world, but always just as solicitous to see the Queen of Heaven's requests accomplished. Section 3, The Hour of Fatima had sounded once more, 1948 to 1950.